Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Casual Coders Podcast, Season 2. Today we've got me, the hardware guy, talking about hardware. Gee, who would have thought? No one would have ever expected that one. I'm joined by Kyle, the AI fanatic, and his friend Larry.
Hello, hello.
I'm so excited because I have so many hardware questions for you today. So I hope you're ready.
I'm a little terrified, but we'll see what happens, you know?
So the hardware in particular that I'm talking about today is around like microcontrollers. Like everyone has like Arduinos and Raspberry Pis, I feel like are the average.
I mean, the Raspberry Pi is not really a microcontroller, but yeah, it's one of the super common ones, right? The Pi, the Arduino, ESP32, NodeMCU, although that's also ESP-based.
Right. And at the time of right now, like I think the most recent Raspberry Pi is a Raspberry Pi 5.
Oh yeah. I thought you were going to say the Pi Pico, which is a microcontroller, being the RP2040. But yeah, it's been out a good while now. It's got Wi-Fi, some other things. It's a competitor to the ESP, I believe.
And the difference between microcontroller versus what you call Pi, what, a full computer?
I would consider the Pi a full computer, yeah.
Is that it runs an operating system.
Yeah, that's one of the big ones, right?
Although technically, there are probably like smaller operating systems that can run on the microcontrollers.
An RTOS, real-time operating system for the microcontroller.
But I think like traditionally, it's just like Mac, Windows, or like a variation of Linux most commonly, especially if you're building your own hardware.
Yeah, primarily Linux is what I would classify a full computer if it can run Linux. Although I guess, I don't know, with modern developments, right, the ESP32 S3 will run mainline Linux kernel, I believe. You can get it to run the mainline Linux kernel. I mean, it takes like five ever to compile, I'm pretty sure. But I did see a guy, they did it, and he got like internet and all sorts of stuff working on it. I know it's a pain in the ass, and it barely runs. I mean, it's like, you know, the slimmest thing. Like, you don't get a web browser. You get maybe the ability to ping Google if you really try, and that's about it.
So if it's running, for example, Linux like they did in that scenario, is it still a microcontroller, would you say? Or is the definition related to the operating system?
I don't know.
It's like a sliding scale, you know? Like
it's
eventually
probably a sliding scale. I mean, realistically, right, if it's powerful enough to run a desktop operating system, then it's a computer. And microcontroller is generally restricted more towards lower, thin, lighter, embedded systems sort of tasks, right? It's a processor that gets embedded inside of some system for use in a larger application, like a car, right? Whole bunch of microcontrollers. Could you call them computers? Yeah, technically, probably. But I think the better term is microcontroller. And I don't have the Wikipedia definition or anything like that.
True, yeah, yeah. This is a more podcasty type scenario, so it makes sense. Because mm-hmm. like I remember in school, Larry and I went to school together, fun fact. Mm-hmm. In our like computer systems class, I believe, we talked about different like modules that existed. Like there's a physical CPU, but then there's more than that, right? Like there's caching. There's
right, you got your CPU, you got your cache, you got your RAM, you got main storage.
And sometimes they have chips that have all of that built in to the die.
Mm-hmm. And most of them.
Under the impression that there's like a term for just the CPU itself versus a term with like it bundled together. I'm forgetting the name. And if we don't remember,
I mean, you could call it like an SOC or an SOM, system on chip, system on module.
And so the system on chip is the one that had a full system built into it, basically, where it has, for example, the CPU.
That's what the ESP32 is classified as. It's a system on chip because it's got the core, it's got the CPU, it's got RAM, it's got flash, it's got everything baked in for the most part. So bootloaders baked in, all that stuff.
And you mean
I mean, you can buy it with the flash not included. I don't really know why you would do that. You're not saving enough money for it to functionally matter, I don't think. But I'm also a hobbyist. I'm producing in scales of, you know, 100 at absolute most, as opposed to some manufacturer who's producing in thousands or tens of thousands for their unit quantity.
And when you say on chip, are you talking about like the physical die that exists, for example, the ESP32?
Correct. I believe so. I mean, it's possible, right? That little black package that makes up a microcontroller is just a piece of plastic. You can put whatever you want inside of it. So you could put several dies that are linked together by gold wire in there if you really wanted. And no one would ever know, right? Unless you're going to take the thing apart and cut it down and sand it and file it and look through it and try to figure out what they've put inside it. But I think probably it's a single chip. It makes the most sense.
I guess the reason why I was asking is because I think the most common way or form factor I've seen them sell that chip is on this little tiny daughter board that you like solder directly to like a main motherboard.
ESP32?
Yeah, like the ESP32.
Yeah, that's their like W Room or W Rover or like Solo modules, which is the little shield. It's FCC certified, like pre-certified for you. So you as the designer developer don't need to go through a whole certification process. Because if you design your own antenna and put that on your PCB and do all this stuff, now you have to contend with the FAA or FCC, not FAA.
Just because you want to make sure that signals don't go everywhere in the air at different frequencies?
Yeah, correct. It's a compliance thing. It's a federal compliance requirement. Like, it's not something you can
that
avoid. Sold,
that are, that's like selling a circuit board, you're saying?
Yeah. If you want to sell it as a product, it has to be approved by the FCC. And those ESP modules come pre-approved. They've got an FCC identifier etched into every single one of them, if you look at them. Whoa. On the little metal shield is the FCC identifier.
I actually never knew that. That is super cool. Can you like have a non-FCC system that's in like a metal box with just the inputs and outputs and then like get that FCC approved better?
I think that like is true. Case. There is something, we talked about this in a class many years ago. But yeah, I think if you sell essentially a Faraday cage box, it might still have to be approved by the FCC. Or it's like a trust system thing where you sell that box, but as soon as a complaint comes in, at great expense to you, the FCC is going to come knocking on your door and say, we need samples of this thing. It needs to be tested in these certified facilities. It's going to cost X hundred thousand dollars. You're going to pay for it, and you have no option but to pay for it. Or maybe stop selling slash remove your product from the market. I don't know the nitty-gritty details of the law. As a hobbyist, I don't have to contend with it. I'm allowed to make five of whatever for the most part, and as long as it's not making any huge issues, it should be fine. Mm.
And then I've heard like there are people that belong to the FCC in some way that like, for example, run around in their car or van with like a little meter and try to figure out where like signals are coming from that they've identified and like go come to your door and be like, you're like, what if like, for example, in my house right now, I made a contraption, turned it on and it jammed a ton of signals into the air. Like, how do people come and find it? Because it would actually cause problems for certain systems.
Someone
sure.
reports that to the FCC, and then they follow up on that report. They go and talk to them, and hey, what stopped working? Why and how? And that's when they start taking measurements and readings. And pretty quickly, if it's a powerful enough source, they'll narrow right down on your location with a directional antenna or something.
And I kind of associate that with like ham clubs that exist across, which I don't remember stands for. It's like a radio club or something like that.
Yeah, ham radio.
But I don't know. Larry, I have a quiz question for you.
Oh, gosh.
It's been a while since you've dealt with microcontrollers and Raspberry Pis and all that, if I recall.
Yeah.
Which ones have you dealt with in school or outside of school? Hobby projects? Question mark.
There's a company called Micro. Is that right? Like Micro something?
Oh, Microchip?
Yeah, Microchip. That's right. Yeah, I think we've worked with those.
Is it Microchip?
In school.
Fuck. Yeah, I think that's right.
It's like an ST series, like ST something.
That's
like
ST Micro.
Micro,
or yeah, ST Microelectronics.
Okay.
Is this for our digital signal processing class, or it was one with? I forget. Man, it's crazy how, like, I graduated, realistically 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's only been 4 years. Already forget this much. It's spooky.
There was the MP Lab stuff with I think Atmel.
That sounds right. We work with an ESP32. That sounds.
We did that.
That acronym
with,
sounds familiar.
We've done that at ESP32 is like a little module that was the successor to an ESP, what is it, 8266?
8266 came first, and then the 32 came and revitalized it and made it significantly better. If you have the option between an 8266 and a 32, pick the 32 every time. I mean, what, it's 40 cents, 20 cents a difference between the two of them, and you get a ton more I.O., you get a ton more features, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, all sorts of stuff. Extra cores on the ESP32, you can get 2-core modules.
I remember, like, I had a Arduino Uno that I think is, the chip in the Arduino Uno is a 18 mega, question mark?
18 mega, 38p.
38p, okay.
Or 328p, my apologies, I forgot the two.
There's a whole, like, meme in, like, the hardware community that, like, you just can immediately identify part numbers that I'm not a pro.
I'm sorry. It is true, right? Yeah.
I just like see other people say it. I'm like, wow, I wish I could get to that level. That's
I amazing. Mean, the common, like the ESP dev modules that we use, those little boards, I think it's DIOW3, the ESP32-DIOW3, or similar enough. I mean, if you search that up, it'll come up with whatever the data sheet is for it.
Yeah. I think like the Arduino Uno that we had, like I, for example, was learning how to program on it and it seemed like super cool.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really not that powerful in comparison to like the ESP8266. And it had Wi-Fi. I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. So going with that chip made a lot of sense for like some of the hobby projects that.
Yeah, for the hobbyist, I'm firmly in the camp. It's ESP32 all the way.
Yeah,
I mean,
bam,
you,
that being
you
the
could
successor,
get an 18 mega 30 or 328p. But why would you? They cost the same as the ESP32. And the ESP32's got way more flash, way more RAM, way more capabilities. remappable pins for your interfaces, I2C, SPI, whatever you need, like digital peripherals. Yeah, plus the Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, two cores, clocked faster by about 5 times, I think. So it's just a better chip for effectively the same cost.
So when we worked on one of our school projects, we needed to basically get a processor. And I'm like, how do we figure out which processor to get? And the answer was, I think there was this company called Microchip.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like a giant list of different processors that we could use.
Mm-hmm. A series breakdown, probably something common that you'll find on their websites.
And we just had to go through it and try to figure out, based on the data sheets, if what their system that they were selling us, like if it would work for what we were trying to do, essentially, right? That's the only way that we had, realistically.
Yeah, and that's universally true, I think, right? I mean, there's the whole chain to figuring out what you're going to use. And the first thing is that starts with selecting a microcontroller, right? A lot of time that starts with setting constraints. These are the things I need it to do, right? Features, capabilities, requirements, that sort of thing, right? Those are big terms. Whereas, you know, I need 3 I2C buses, or I need 2 SPI interfaces. I need 34 general purpose IO digital. I need 18 analog pins. Well, that's a pretty difficult requirement. You're going to have to find something different if you need 18 analog pins.
Because 18 is way too many. Most come with like, what, 4?
Most come with 4, roughly, yeah. 4 or 5, maybe 6 if you're lucky. And some of them, I think there are certain STM32s that have like a bunch of them, like 16 maybe. And you'll find a lot of that information in different like series breakdowns. I know the STM series breakdown by heart, so I can give it to you. The F series is their general purpose, or the F series is their like high performance series of CPUs or MCUs. Below that is the L series, I believe, which is their general purpose, like low power sort of integrated E stuff. And there's also the G series, which is, I think, even lower power, even smaller form factor. They're all sufficiently feature rich. I mean, even the smallest, like G0, comes with 2 I2C interfaces, I think, and like 2 SPI interfaces. You literally can't use them all because the package only has 8 pins. But yeah, I mean, they're loaded down with all sorts of crazy features, everything you could ever need, anything you could think of. That's roughly that. And then, of course, there's a bunch inside each of those series. So there's F0, F1, F2, F3, F4, F7. And 0 is the lowest power, slowest, right? Because power and speed are, you know, they're related.
Right.
The faster you can clock, the more operations you can complete in a second, therefore
more power.
Right. So then the F7 is obviously the highest power. And as part of that, it also ranges in terms of flash memory and RAM. Or, yeah, ROM, however you want to say that. Lower power, smaller package, less RAM. Higher power, bigger package, more RAM. And then the top end, I think, is the H series, which is 2 cores. It's like 0.5 gig of like onboard flash and I think 1/4 in memory, which is huge. It's an ungodly quantity on just a microcontroller. I mean, we were talking about the ESP32 having a lot. It dwarfs the ESP32. I mean, the ESP32 looks like an ant compared to the F set or the H7s. It's insane.
But I'm under the impression, like, when you get to those higher level chips, it takes a ton more passives in order to get them, like, online on a circuit board.
Yeah, I mean, if you're dealing with a chip that has 8 pins, how many decoupling caps do you really need? 1, 2, maybe 3, if you're really going at it. But if you have a package that has 256 pins and 16 VCC inputs, you got to have a decoupling cap at each of those pins that you can provide extra current flowing in when the chip needs a bunch, when it's doing some operation where it starts sucking in a lot of power. That's what that decoupling cap does. It acts as localized energy storage at each of those input pins
they can pull from in the case it needs it.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember we were trying to do some Fourier transform analysis. And when selecting a chip, we really wanted to do a lot of operations per second.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, I remember the term like DSP.
Was digital signal processing?
Yeah. But in particular, I think in respect to like the chip itself, like, oh, this is a DSP chip. Mm-hmm. Is that just a name that's given to chips that can process enough, essentially?
There are dedicated digital signal processing chips that are like collections of op amps and other things that are generally associated with, I know it was a class in the computer engineering line, I believe, that talked about that, where, you know, solve all these equations associated with this collection of op amps to figure out what the signal looks like. Here's my input. Show me what the output is going through this chain of op amps, or, you know, run the math to perform this DSP operation to take an input and convert it to an output that is vastly different. Like it's a similar thing to Laplace transforms, where you take some input and you pull out like a phase and some other stuff from that signal, magnitude and phase.
And do some frequency analysis on it.
Yep. Which is fast Fourier transform, right? It's what it does. It takes in an input signal in, oh God, what is it? Time or continuous domain. And then it spits out a thing in S domain or time domain. So you can look at it. And I think what the general effect of that is it's looking at an analog input and then you run it through an FFT and you can get a frequency plot where you'll have spikes at each major frequency component of the signal.
Yeah, spike at 1 hertz, spike at like 100 hertz.
Yeah, what is a typical human speak around 1K to 2K, I think. So you'd see spikes there for this.
Yeah, all the way up to 20K. If you're really screeching, realistically, we only hear like the highest screech that you hear is like 8K.
You're not going to get to 20K as a human. But
when you're born, hypothetically, that's what they say. I don't know. So
come out of the womb at 20 kilohertz.
Literally, that's why you're crying. You're like, ah, so much signal. I can hear the lights.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, right?
They actually have tests that you can do. You can download and it'll go.
I mean, as long as your headphones can actually reproduce that signal, right?
Which most
there's
can.
The whole thing.
Almost all headphones.
It depends. I don't know if you've ever seen the like headphone plot, right? Where here's your baseline response and it slopes off a little bit and then it comes up and then it overshoots a little bit on the mids and then it comes down and then it goes all squirrely way up near 20 kilohertz. Like, I don't know if I really trust.
Yeah, but that's near like 20 kilohertz. Like during that whole section, like you can still hear at least. Like it might not be exactly reproducing what was recorded at the time.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
But you can still see if it makes a noise and you can detect it.
Slowly scroll up and down through 20 kilohertz to find where you can stop hearing it and start hearing it and realize you've damaged your hearing and slowly decreases. Right. I don't know.
So do you remember now which of those microcontrollers that we use? So we use the like the DSP.
I mean,
with,
we've listed so many.
Right, yeah.
I feel like we had a combination of two. Like we had like a PIC combined with
Yeah, what was PIC in response to?
Isn't PIC more like a general purpose microprocessor?
Yeah,
is it
would
line
be.
Of processors?
Yeah, it's the PIC 16, PIC 32. I think the 16 is an 8-bit microcontroller. I don't remember what architecture it is. It's something, who knows, doesn't matter. And then PIC 32 is the 32-bit version of the PIC system. I think that's by Microchip as well.
Because one of us was working on like the Fourier transform stuff and actually getting it to work. What was the other chip that we were using?
I mean, I think they were on the same board. I don't know. I don't even remember. Does it make any sense to have a DSP mixed with the
Yeah, a lot. Purpose? You have one master controller that does all the stuff, and then you've got your main like timing sensitive mission critical thing over here that does just one thing and one thing alone really well. And then all of your inputs and outputs are handled over here. And then this will send an interrupt at the right time to your main like big boy processor and say, hey, you need to do this. And this is the configuration for it. And then it just takes in a signal and does its thing the entire time. It's that delegation. It's like the idea of two cores, right? You have one big core that does the mission critical application. And then you've got some low power coprocessor over here that takes in extra inputs from the program and reconfigures him and, you know,
gets what he needs as a helper.
Chains everything, figures out the timing of things, you know, when to start doing X process and like it's the ordering, the structuring of when to send commands.
Yeah, for our project, the general purpose one was probably like sending stuff over like UART to, it was like going to a Raspberry Pi, right?
Correct, yeah.
I don't want to say we had it configured, yeah, to like take in that. So we probably had, yeah, the DSP talking to the general purpose, then talking over to a Raspberry Pi, if I remember right.
Yeah, and connect to the DSP was like a microphone, so that way we can get like the raw voltage. And the goal was to like do the fast Fourier transform on it to get that chart that we were talking about of the different frequencies, because the different frequencies are associated with like different notes that you hear. So if you go to a piano and you play an A, it's going to be a multiple of 220 hertz that you're hearing versus a B or a C, like they're different frequency notes. So if you were like playing at a piano, which is what our student design project here, Pitchford student design project, it's been a long time. Mm-hmm. Do you remember?
Barely.
It was essentially like it was a device that you can place on your physical grand piano or connect up to your digital MIDI piano. And in the case where you're on your grand piano, you can play a song, essentially, and it would read what you did and tell you how well you did while you played it. In addition, it was connected to an augmented reality headset, at the time the Microsoft HoloLens, and overlaid over the keyboard were these notes that like fell from the sky.
Mm-hmm. Like the synthesizer stuff that you can see on YouTube or whoever does it.
Exactly. I
mean, it's all over.
100%. And so you like, just like select your song if you didn't know how to play something, and the notes would fall from the sky and it would tell you, basically like Guitar Hero style almost, how well you did, which is super cool. On a grand piano, using the DSP board, and then also just using straight up MIDI input.
How well did it work?
It worked, I'd say. So the problem is it was during COVID,
mm-hmm.
and we were trying to front load all of our development. So like we were going hard. We wanted like a really nice, like amazing theme design project. And then it got to like the 6-week point and COVID hit. And they're like, by the way, we're having COVID. You got to go home. Since you can't go into the lab and work on it, just turn in your paper and your grade will be purely based off of your paper. You're like, no, you're literally like throwing away all the work from our other classes so that way we can, you know, dive into this. But it ended up being okay because we still ended up with a really cool tune design project. I have a video of it somewhere that I can.
Oh, all right. I'll have to take a look at that at some point.
Yeah. But like, if it was in order, there was like a setup process to it. So like when you sat down, you had to like, it put a guess where it thinks the keyboard was, and you'd take a second to like adjust the four pins to like be the corners of your piano. And like you had input what, how many keys it was, and from that it could figure out the placement.
Gotcha.
And then that was like the relative placement, and how well it like actually detected the keys, I don't remember, honestly. I think I remember it working for quite a bit, but I don't know if we, it would have been more extensively tested if COVID had not hit, but yeah. I remember us at least having great initial success, which is good. One of our people on our team was crazy and would come into the office like every single day for like 4 or 5 hours a day while he's trying to get the fast Fourier transform code working.
Holy cow. That's a long time.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a full-time job right there.
He was dedicated.
Plus school.
Yep. So yeah, that guy's a legend. Shout out to our senior design team. Companion, compatriot, whatever.
Compatriot.
That sounds American. I like that.
But yeah. Okay. So we had these processors, right? And we had to program them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there being two different ways to program them. One being like if the processor had a bootloader on it,
mm-hmm.
and you just had to plug it into it with USB, and it went through this other chip that existed on the board, I think, and then that talked to the bootloader, and it used the bootloader like programmed itself essentially, except not the bootloader itself, because like so you have EEPROM, right, and in EEPROM that's being programmed, as I understand it, the first like when you turn it on. Like the processor starts basically at the very start of EEPROM and starts executing. And so that's where the bootloader exists. And so when you turn it on and there's normally one of the pins high, you select it and or the bootloader sees that and it knows, oh, it's my time to shine. And it is what like takes in some sort of serial and like writes to the rest of the EEPROM, not including where the bootloader is. It doesn't want to overwrite itself. That makes sense.
Right. That would be correct.
Is everything I said right there the correct process?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, yeah.
And that process is...
And there are differences depending on which microcontroller you're using. Like the ESP32's bootloader is flashed on its own dedicated read-only memory. So it doesn't touch flash ever. I mean, you start at the zero point of flash with an ESP32 where the program starts. The bootloader is separate.
Could we make a couple of distinctions of definitions here for my own sake? So there's ROM, read-only memory. There's RAM.
Random access memory. And there's PSRAM, which I don't remember what the PS stands for, but that's ESP32 speak.
And then there's EEPROM or EEPROM, I've heard.
EEPROM, electronically erasable, programmable read-only memory.
And there's flash.
Yeah.
How are these terms? What are they defined as and how are they related?
EEPROM and flash are very similar. I'm not sure there's a huge... I don't know if I can easily articulate the difference between them. I'm not sure I know the difference between them, quite frankly.
But we know we think as of right now, like it's where programs go when they're...
Correct, yeah. I mean, you put a program in flash memory and it sort of stays there until you erase that flash memory and replace it with something new. I think maybe the difference is EEPROM, you can select a bit or bytes to replace selectively. And flash, when you're reprogramming, I think you're reprogramming the whole thing in one go. You don't have the option of selecting a few words or a few hundred bytes and replacing those. I think it's either all of it or none of it. I could be mistaken, though. I'm not 100% certain.
And both of those are quote-unquote ROM, right? EEPROM ends with ROM.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense that it's ROM. And as far as I understand it, in a processor, normally there tends to be both RAM and ROM.
Mm-hmm. You need RAM, right? You need somewhere to store your variables and perform your calculations and put your math into.
Perfect, yeah. And then ROM is where the the initial code goes that it's flash with. That is the binary that goes. Or would you regularly, when programming your code, just throw it all in ROM?
That depends how the architecture is set up. It's sort of one of those architectural questions, and it varies for every microcontroller, every line, however the company that designed it has designed it.
So let's talk about the ESP32, since we talked a lot about that earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's got ROM and it's got flash. Those two are totally distinct things. There's 320 kilobytes or kilobits of ROM, which stores the bootloader. And then there's any number, any amount of flash that you want to give that chip, from 0 bytes, which is unusable. You couldn't do anything with that because the bootloader is on the ROM. You can't overwrite that. And then there is up to whatever, a gig or 8 gigs of flash memory. You can connect a full SD card to it through the SPI lanes, because an SD card is just glorified SPI. And you could connect up an SD card that's 8 gigs or more to it.
SPI here stands for?
Serial Programmable Interface. Is that right?
That sounds right.
Something to me. Similar. It's a serial interface.
Perfect. So then, hypothetically, the bootloader that exists on ROM after it's not being programmed would determine, okay, I don't need a program. And then it starts your code, quote unquote.
Yeah, on the ESP32, the bootloader is always going to be the first thing that runs. And it's going to check the state of GPIO 0. That is the boot pin on the ESP32. So when the pin gets reset and comes back on, it's going to look at that boot pin. And if that boot pin is held low, I think, it's going to say, okay, I'm ready to overwrite the flash and put new data there. And if that pin is high, it says, oh, normal run mode, and targets the start of the flash memory. And that's where it kicks from and starts running its stuff. Or some other address, wherever the compiler states inside of that flash memory. Because you can also use that flash memory as storage on the microcontroller. There's the SPI file system. So for an ESP32, you can create a data directory in Platform.io, which is the IDE, and tell it to upload some files. Super common thing would be like an index.html file. And it'll serve that as a web server right from its internal flash memory to you, the user, when you hit its IP address.
That makes sense. So, okay, suppose that I want to talk about the flashing process, right? In an ESP32, quite a few of the boards that I've seen straight up come with either USB-C or micro USB if they're a little older.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can plug in my USB-C cable and go on my either Arduino IDE or Platform.io and hit compile, and suppose my code compiles because I'm a good programmer, and aka I copy-paste from the internet.
I mean, how far in the weeds do you want to get here?
let's go levels first, right? So let's say from compilation, we'll not talk about how, but eventually it turns it into bytecode.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, right.
You have this bytecode that you want to
take your C code that you want to write, and then it converts it into assembly code. And it compiles it into a binary or a hex file that you want to push onto the microcontroller, which is some number of bits, bytes, it doesn't matter, whatever. It's a file that we want to flash.
Yeah, I have this file, and I want it to physically go into the flash memory on the ESP32. That's my goal. And so step one, I plug in the USB-C. So it goes through the COM port over serial, which...
Depends.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. It's such a nuanced thing, right?
100%, yeah. Give it to me how it is.
Okay. So it depends on which chip you've got. Mm-hmm. The S series, which are presently the ESP32's flagship microcontrollers, there's S2 and S3. S3 is Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and may have two cores. The S2 is Wi-Fi only, no Bluetooth, and a single core. I commonly use the S2 because they're cheaper and they do everything I need them to do. Those have a built-in USB on-the-go interface. So you can put it in bootloader mode and plug in a USB, and it sends the data right over the USB data lines. I think it shows up as a USB CDC device. It's effectively a virtual COM port. So it fakes a serial interface just using the USB protocol. Older boards don't have that, and you have two other options, JTAG or TTL UART. JTAG is super common on just about everything. It's like the general purpose programming. I don't remember exactly what it stands for, but you'll see it fairly commonly. It's 6 or so pins, up to 10, and it just has, it's a serial wire interface where data can be sent onto the chip, and it's used for debugging and for uploading new code. It's what you'll use in mainline production if you're producing 100,000 units. Each one of them will have like gold fingers that come down onto the board, touch it, provide it power, flash the chip, verify it, run some unit tests and debugging on it to make sure that it's working, and then they'll lift up and move to the next board, and they'll do the same thing on that production line as it goes along.
And if I'm an engineer, we're saying, like, I have my laptop, I have a USB, go to a physical JTAG box device.
Yeah, it's just another microcontroller that does the JTAG protocol and interfaces via USB.
And then on that JTAG device is where the 6 to 10 little wires go onto the microcontroller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it also happens where, like, you turn on the microcontroller and hit this with 0 volts and or make sure this pin is low and at the time of boot. And then from there, it'll continue on.
JTAG might be a little more advanced. It might be able to say, hey, stop, I'm here, and stop the program halfway through, mm-hmm. and then add new stuff and send commands more digitally, less reset required. Although usually there's a reset pin included in there. So yeah, probably that interface of 6 pins resets the chip, pulls the right pin low, and says, hey, I'm here, you're going to do this, here's your new code, I want to see what this is happening here, let me see register number 8001. Let me see this register. Let me see this line of code. And it'll communicate and send data back and forth and say, this is what this variable is right now. And here's this address in RAM.
And it's the JTAG device doing that, which means that there actually does not need to be a bootloader on the chip.
Correct. Effectively, you're offloading the bootloader and you're looking at flash and you're looking at some registers inside of there. Yeah, I think that's an acceptable way of
describing
that.
I have a random detail to sidetrack. You just jogged my memory from like, I don't know, 12 years ago. I remember the Xbox 360, people would mod their Xboxes. And if I recall, they actually used JTAG to do that. Are you familiar, Ian?
Not immediately. Yeah. I was expecting that you were going to go with the drilling a hole in the CPU to hit the wire that was locking the memory so that it could then be rewritten. Okay. But yeah.
Yeah, they would mod their Xbox with JTAG. I don't know how you do that.
I guess step one
connects up and it communicates, right?
Yeah, step one is you buy a JTAG connector off eBay, right? And step two is you plug it into your laptop and get some GitHub repositories code to throw on there. And then you have to open your Xbox. You'll find the processor that's that silicon chip there with all the wires sticking out. And you attach the wires to the chip that you need.
Not the chip. There's usually gold pads or some pad
that are off of the chip.
Right. It's somewhere on the PCB, right? Because it has to be touched down. I mean, with really old stuff, like jelly bean packages, as they're called.
Fun name.
Yeah. What's the standard? DIP package, dual inline package. It's the little big, like, black guy. It's what the ATmega 328P is. There are little clips that you can have. It's a little clip that's JTAG, and it connects right over top all the leads, and it touches each leg of the component just in place on the board, and you can interface with it that way.
Yeah, because most of the, like, for example, an Xbox, most of the processors on really high power stuff has a ton of different.
It's all BGA, ball grid array. There's a
pins.
Yeah. It's a square matrix, right? Like an Excel sheet, I guess, of little solder balls below the package. And then that gets flipped over and put down onto the board for a bunch of matching little points on the board. And then those all get melted and it solders down and touches. I mean, there's no access to anything in the middle of that if you really want.
So you program it pre putting it on the board normally?
No, you would still put it on the board. Right.
And then have the traces go to an area that you're saying, and then you touch down there.
Right. Exactly. You'd have the debug pads pulled out to some header on the board. And I don't know. I mean, I imagine that's different for like an actual AMD, like CPU, a full CPU that's got X number of cores and runs x86, x64 architecture. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they get pre-flashed with anything or if it just runs. I mean, it starts, it looks in the program counter, it starts looking RAM or CPU. I mean, there's the bootloader, I guess, would be BIOS, right? In your motherboard, it needs a motherboard to turn on. So there's some memory that it looks for on that chipset or in the BIOS flash that it reads to start with. And then that tells it, oh, you need to look here on this SATA bus to find the Windows bootloader. And then that runs, which tells it to look for the other place for the operating system.
Yeah,
so it's this chain of jump, 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 which I guess brings me to a really funny, like, quick off-topic thing, which is, as a programmer, right, always avoid go-tos, right?
100%.
They're terrible bad practice. But if we dig down under the hood, all assembly is just a bunch of go-tos. It's jump and link, baby. That's all it is. There is no if. Well, there is an if statement, but there is no while loop. It's go-to, right? Jump and link. If this condition, then jump here. Otherwise, jump to this register.
Yep.
Because that's all it can do.
Because if you do step one, step two, step three, step four, step five, step six, and then you have a jump two command all the way up to step one, that's a while loop. There we go.
Yeah.
Assembly. Woo.
Exactly. But yeah, does that make sense, I think? Yeah. I don't know if I'm too far off topic now.
Nope. Yeah, yeah, we're good.
It was my fault.
No, you're
no,
good.
No, no, now we know.
And then there's one other way to program an ESP32.
Being the TTL-UART?
TTL-UART, yeah, which is transistor-transistor logic, generally 3.3 volts, because the ESP32 is a 3.3 volt system. Although it's 5 volt tolerant, you could get away with 5 volts if you want on the input pins. Don't give it 5 volts on the voltage pins or you will fry it. But the I.O. are 5 volt tolerant. So you pull the pins low, which is what the UART connector does. A big enough UART like the FTDI has a reset pin on it and a DIR or DTR pin. It's like ready to receive, ready to send, clear to send. There's a whole bunch of them. The standard is publicly available. And it pulls that pin low and then it pulls the boot pin low with another command that's sent on the UART bus to the controller that says, hey, pull this low, pull this low. And then it sends commands which go USB. They get converted with dedicated IC and ASIC, application-specific integrated circuit, USB to serial. And then that serial goes to the serial interface of the ESP32, and it accepts that and programs the flash. And then it queries back the flash memory and verifies it, make sure it's correct, and no bits got flipped or anything weird during programming.
And that intermediary device is normally on the chip as well, or it's on the circuit board?
No, it's on the PCB itself. PCB. Cheap and common is the CH340 by, I don't know, WCH. The other common one is FTDI. It's
FT232RL, question mark?
Yep, there you go, FT232RL.
Gotcha.
And that's all TTL. You've also probably heard RS232, which is older style serial. That's the full fat serial bus. TTL starts at 5 volts and goes down to 0 volts. 5 volts is a 0. 0 volts is a 1. RS232 starts at positive up to like 20 volts for a 0 and goes to negative 20 volts for a 1. If you try to use a TTL UART adapter on an RS232 bus, it will do nothing because it's not going to receive a single 1 during any of that communication. It's got to go negative below 5 volts or below 3 volts, whatever the threshold is. Data sheet will tell you.
And if you do the opposite, it'll probably break it.
Right, exactly. And if you reverse bias a, you know, ESP32 with negative 20 volts, that blows it up.
That makes sense, yep. That'll do it. So I kind of in my mind have two different scenarios, right? One is I plug in my USB device and hit go from a functional standpoint and it works. And the ones that we just talked about that do that are the TTL, maybe the RS232, assuming that's on.
It's effectively the same thing as TTL UART. It's just different logic levels.
But what handles that is the chip that's between my USB interface.
Between your USB connector, right?
Yeah, there's a USB connector, goes to the USB chip. Mm-hmm. USB chip goes to
microcontroller.
I thought it goes. So, all right, this is different than what I thought. So that's why I'm glad we went over this, okay? Oh, man. Okay, so we have the USB-C connector.
Huh?
And I was under the impression that there's a specific chip that converts, for example, the USB-C connector into like the normal USB-A, like serial-ish type interface.
No, the USB connector just pulls out those USB data lines. It's USB like data plus, USB data minus.
And then like ground and 5 volts.
Ground, 5 volts. USB-C's
and a normal USB.
Got the 20 connectors. Those are extra buses on top of data plus, data minus. You need data plus, data minus in there, which establishes your initial connection, mm-hmm. and then those extra pins get used as your high-speed throughput because you can't get all of that in on only two wires, so it adds additional twisted pairs. I think it's 4 additional twisted pairs mm-hmm. in there, and that's your high-speed communication bus. Think of it like Ethernet, right? I mean, if you pull three of your twisted pairs out of your Ethernet cable, you've really neutered your Ethernet option, right? You get 100%. Maybe 10 megabit at most, a megabit, some whatever.
Slow I mean, it's still pretty high, I think, but...
I mean, it's still fairly high. Mm-hmm. But then if you add those extra differential pairs back in, you can get up to a gigabit or 10 gigabit, depending on what Ethernet you're running. So it's the exact same concept, right? For USB 3.0, it's just adding more data lines to send more data concurrently. Because otherwise, you need a super high frequency, which is really hard to deal with, right?
So you're saying that the USB-A connector I'm using or the USB-C connector I'm using...
It's all the same.
Just basically, you'll have the two data lines go to this FT232RL chip or CH340 chip, depending on which one you're using.
Right, depending on what you're using.
And, or the third chip for RS232.
That would be like a MAX232, which is its own thing. The MAX232 is just a logic level shifter. It doesn't convert USB to TTL. It just takes in existing TTL UART and converts it to RS232. Which is just that logic level shifting from 5 volts, 0 to 5 volts, and then pushes it up to, I think it's officially like 8 and negative 8 or 6.5 and negative 6.5. It's somewhere in that range, but the actual accepted range is like 15 to negative 15.
And then from that intermediary chip to the processor that actually...
Right, you get transmit and receive UART, that standard bus, right? 9600 baud. RX-TX, you've probably seen them all before. Yeah, and then you
connect
send,
an RX to a TX and then correct, the TX to an RX.
Right, you take a receive, goes to a transmit, and then transmit goes to receive, which is what those stand for, RX being receive, TX being transmit. So then data is transmitted on that bus to the receive pin of one device, and then that device transmits back to the receive pin of your USB converter.
And all of that together is called TTL.
TTL is a general term. It just stands for transistor logic.
Just the fact that you're using transistors to program?
It's in the logic levels for the most part. TTL is commonly 5 volts, 3.3 volts. I think you can go as low as like 1.8. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a blanket term. It doesn't really mean anything in particular in this tool chain. I mean, really the only keyword is UART.
Yeah, that's the name of the actual protocol.
The name of the communication protocol.
The TX and RX that you're talking
Universal
about.
Universal Asynchronous Serial Transmission, I don't know, whatever. USART.
So then from a functional perspective as a programmer, right? That's a board that I want to deal with because it makes it nice and easy for me as a programmer that knows like this line does this, this line does this, this line does this. And I might still need to interface directly with a processor that interfaces with either sensors or, you know, mechanical components. That makes it nice for me. However, the other way, that's not too much extra effort, but you need that intermediary physical device that I have on my desk, right? So it goes from my laptop as through USB port to the physical other device, which is called...
JTAG, or honestly, it might be an external FTDI device, right? It just removes that device from the circuit and puts it in a black box on your desk instead. What that does is it makes it more difficult for someone to just plug in and connect up to it via USB. Mm-hmm. They need to have that same device. It also reduces your cost. The FT232RL is $5 a chip. Why would I put that on every single one of my devices when no one's supposed to open that thing up and no one needs to
be able to
communicate
it.
With it? I don't want someone else reprogramming my thing. I mean, I as a hobbyist obviously do, but as a manufacturer or some big corporation, I don't want people reprogramming my thing, so I'm not going to put that on there. I'm going to make it external on my assembly line, and my assembly line programs it, and I don't include that cost. You've now removed capacitors, resistors, you've decreased the amount of solder joints, you've opened up more board space to put something else there, and you've reduced that huge $5 cost of that component.
Yeah, that makes total sense then. The other thing I've heard it called is an AUR probe. Mark II, for example, is the name of a device that might be used through USB to program a device.
Not familiar with it, but yeah, a lot of companies have their own, you know, standards or whatever. I mean, STMicro has got the ST-Link, which is their own two-wire or serial wire debug interface, SWD, two wires. It's got a clock and a data line, so it puts data on the data line and it clocks the clock, and then it changes that data and it clocks the clock, and it changes that data and it clocks the clock. I guess if you're familiar with a shift register, right? Very similar sort of thing. Same with I2C, right? Where you put some data on the bus and you clock that into the chip that stores that data into flash or wherever it goes.
And are these on a per like manufacturer type basis of the CPU?
Yeah, for the most part.
Okay.
JTAG is the one that's most universal.
Across multiple different manufacturers.
Mm-hmm. ESP32 supports JTAG. STM32 is JTAG. I assume that the PIC and similar also have a JTAG interface. Most things do. I don't know if some of the AVR microcontrollers commonly used in Arduinos have a JTAG interface. They might. I haven't seen any in datasheets, but I haven't looked that close.
So then if you look in a datasheet, will there be a line item that says, oh, TTL, JTAG?
Yeah, fairly commonly. You'll see like JTAG or UART or USB CDC / USB on the go is also common. OTG. A lot of three-letter acronyms.
Yeah. What is that last one? Because those
OTG?
Were not in the list.
USB CDC.
Or
I don't remember what exactly it is. I'm not going to try to make up that acronym because it could be anything really. Yeah. But yeah, it's.
But you think it's a way of programming the chip?
It's a virtual COM port. Yeah. I mean, it's just getting data into the chip, same way as any of the other methods.
Okay, gotcha. So then it's totally possible that if, for example, a chip supports. Or I guess let me ask the question outright instead. In this method where I have a USB device go to one of these manufacturer provided programming devices to the, and I want to program said CPU, is the interface between the manufacturer device and the CPU often, for example, also TTL? It probably depends on the manufacturer, now that I, you know, ask the question out loud. But because I guess what I'm wondering is, like, could I have a processor work both with the TTL way that we talked about and with one of the provided methods?
I have clearly messed you up with TTL because, like I said, it's just a blanket statement. Mm-hmm. USB is TTL. It's transistor logic. It's 0 volts for ground, or 0 volts for a zero and 5 volts for a one. Or the opposite of that is also TTL. It's just that, you know, we have two logic levels, zero and some positive voltage, whatever that may be. 3 volts, 1.8, 5, all of those are common.
So a name, for example, of a type of TTL being the RS-232, and a name of a type of TTL being UART?
RS-232 is not TTL. Because it's got that positive-negative swing, it's not TTL.
Oh, so TTL has to be 0 and something else.
I believe it's 0 and 5, yeah.
Okay, by definition.
Or 0 and one other, yeah, one voltage.
So then, hypothetically, if I wanted a processor that I'm currently programming with a provided interface, and I want to make, for some reason, a dev board or something, and so I want this interface to exist on the chip itself, I would have to hope that either A, that they used a nice like TTL UART programming method that I can find a chip that is able to do the conversion for me through a USB connection, or I'd have to basically design my own circuitry to remake whatever the programmer is doing in order to do that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that would commonly be JTAG.
Right? Yeah, if it's JTAG, then you're good to go because you can just find a JTAG.
Good to go, you can find JTAG stuff. And JTAG is a little locked down. I don't know exact details. I mean, a lot of it's like a software implementation. Common tools, the Blackmagic Debug Probe, which is just an STM32F4 processor on that board. And then it implements the SWD, the serial wire debug, the ST-Link stuff. And it also has JTAG options and UART. It sort of has all three of those for dealing with ST micro products.
Gotcha. So then I guess there was actually another senior design team in our school when we were doing this that their whole goal was to make a master programmer, essentially,
mm-hmm.
where this method where you needed a external box, they were tired of like needing a bunch of different ones on their desk.
Right, so you make one generalized external box that'll do anything. Yeah.
And you plug into it. It has a nicely labeled external ports. Plug it into whatever processor you want, and bam, you're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so hypothetically, that's possible. There's not really any reason that I can think of. That.
No, there's not really any reason, right? I don't know.
You just have to, maybe some of these, you might have to reverse engineer how they do their programming, I suppose.
I mean, it should be in the data sheet, right? If it's good, right? Because I need to be able to actually implement it. If your protocol is some weird special proprietary thing that I can't implement into my assembly line, I'm going to go with some other micro, like some other fab, someone else who has something I can more easily interface with my existing tooling.
I figured
so they're generally pretty similar, pretty standardized.
That's good, because I was under the impression that maybe they'd want to keep it relatively locked down, and then they just hand you a device that can do it to put in your fab as you.
And I'm sure that does happen as well, but I think for the most part it's fairly open and it's documented in the data sheet. I mean, I've never read a full data sheet. They're 500 pages for a microcontroller. I don't need to know all of that information. I don't need to know the full register map for an ESP32. That's been taken care of for me. I don't need to deal with it.
100%. I just need to know what you need to know, and that's it.
Right, and I already know more than I need to for the most part. I mean, I'm at a point where I could design any little ESP32 thing I want. I could deal with ATtiny and AVR, Atmel, probably PIC32, PIC16, even though I haven't touched them in years.
That's one of the things I find super frustrating, though, about like the EE world, is you're trying to implement this thing, and you're handed a 500-page data sheet, and it kind of becomes your responsibility to be responsible for knowing every single thing that there is to know about this processor.
Yeah.
And it just is how it is. I'm looking forward to the day where we have large language models read these data sheets and really heavily keep track of everything. Right now, like, a service level implementation would probably like be very helpful, but the thing about large language models is that sometimes they hallucinate and mm-hmm. are not like exactly, they're getting better at.
You want just like a well-labeled, well-organized, like easily Googleable data sheet or something. Yeah, easily searchable maybe is the right way to say that. Because yeah, they can be daunting and painful. And I mean, I mentioned it somewhere, but occasionally you'll get a series breakdown in place of a data sheet. So you click download data sheet and it's 2 pages long. And all it does is it's like, okay, well, this CPU has this much RAM and this one's got this much RAM on board and this one's got this much. And hey, this one has these abilities. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, this is nothing that I needed. I needed to like actually see typical implementation diagrams and schematics and layout samples and the block diagram, the functional overview, the pinout. There's all sorts of things you need.
Yeah, so when you say that you looked through a 500-page data sheet and you didn't read all of it, how did you know what you needed to find and what you needed to read? You just looked through that first page.
Control F.
But what if like the engineers that made the data sheet call it something different than what you as?
It's called Control F, and you look around for it, and you're like, oh, what could it possibly be? Okay, yeah, all right. Well, maybe here's some key terms for that thing. Oh, yeah, okay, here it is. Why'd they call it that? Oh, come on, guys.
And you just remember what they called it. So next time
you go to the or you look through the index, right? Yeah, I mean, you know, the table of contents has information, and you can generally find it. They're laid out fairly similarly. It starts with a functional description and the functional overview, and then pretty quickly thereafter is the pinout and, you know, typical characteristics. Section 3 is usually like all of the functioning components, all of the subsystem breakdowns. So like UART would be a subsystem, and I2C is a subsystem, and the real-time clock is a subsystem, and, you know, the embedded ultra-low-power coprocessor is its own subsystem that only accepts assembly code, and whatever, it's the list of subsystems. And then Section 4 is some other things, pinouts, implementation diagrams, electrical subsystems, and then you just get a little deeper into the weeds. Like, this is your max ratings. You can run this chip at, you know, a maximum voltage of 4 volts, and anything above that will kill it. This is not recommended. The recommended voltage is 3.6.
So I've definitely seen, like, in engineering teams, it becomes a lead hardware engineer's full role and responsibility to re-implement this chip into their own, say, like, full like motherboard that they have for their own like custom
ECB that they're doing. Yeah, because during dev work, a lot of the time you get a pre-made dev kit from the supplier. They make dev boards, dev modules, something that's got a bunch of peripherals and all sorts of crap on it that you don't really need, but you can program, and they've got the built-in programmer and everything. So you just plug it in and you write some code and you flash it, and it's, you know, to make your iteration much faster. So you don't have to think about how to implement it and how to do any of that stuff. And then someone else can go and take all of that information and condense it down into their own schematic following the typical implementation guidelines.
But then to even just follow the typical implementation guidelines, I've seen it take like weeks to like make sure you have every single piece in place.
Right, which is why you have that development board to work on. So you can still do work while someone else is implementing the actual thing.
That makes sense.
Right, it's sort of working in parallel.
Yeah, I totally agree there. I guess what I don't understand is why don't the manufacturers of this chip give you like design files that you can just automatically import into, for example, your KiCad or KiCad, whatever it's called, you know, software that then, bam, places it in a nice, you know, stink package that then you can just work off of.
I think some of them have similar stuff, sort of.
It would just save like weeks of time, I feel like, if they did that. And they are doing that internally, right?
That's the layout sample. I'm sure they'll help you if you're a big enough company and you reach out. I'm sure they've got layout samples. I mean, another thing is there are just so many different like CAD packages. Yeah, I mean, like there's Altium, programs. There's Cadence, there's KiCad, there's...
DX Designer.
Yeah, right. There's so many of them. I mean, the list's like 18 long. It's a little unreasonable to expect them to maintain up-to-date like implementations or samples for every single one of those different designers for every single one of their microcontrollers. Because the sample, like the list of CPUs is huge.
Right, but the people who make...
all of the little changes, mm-hmm. right? Because there's four different packages and eight different versions, and each of those eight versions has four different packages for one thing in the stack. That's just F0. Now we move on to F1, which has the same. I mean, it's that huge tree. It is a colossal number of...
But they already have those files because they had to physically make their own PCB and test it themselves also.
They might. I don't know. I don't know how they implement it, right? I mean, it's totally possible it's all tested in a jig somewhere in the fab, right? It gets put in that plastic component and then just pressed down on some jig that runs it through the tests and applies the capacitance and does everything automatically, and it never sees like a typical implementation thing. Like in the real world, it's not like they designed a PCB for it or anything like that. They give you the reference schematic, which is, hey, we think you need these things here. But I don't know if they have like a reference layout. Some ICs do, and it's in the data sheet. Here's the reference layout. Your CAD software will differ from ours, so just copy this and use it. And it's also very difficult because, I mean, they might design it some way, but you're going to implement it totally differently. You want this capacitor over here, and suddenly it's way different. I mean, you're going to pull your data lines out from a different side. It's just easier to let a skilled engineer do it themselves. They'll be faster in the long run than taking your example, stripping it all apart, and then rebuilding it taking the schematic, implementing their schematic, and then placing down the components and building it yourself from scratch.
In my experience, I've seen at least 75% of engineers, for their use case, the base case works for them. And they just have to waste the 2.5 weeks to make the design themselves. And I mean, it's only 2.5 weeks of effort, but still, it's like your main hardware engineer that could be working on other things. So that just sounds like it is the way that it is for now.
It's also possible that they do provide those things. Yeah, I don't know. I've not reached out to anyone. I've not had to. I mean, I have...
On their websites, I haven't seen the files of it.
I haven't seen files, no.
It seems to me that like...
Nordic Semiconductor has PDFs that are mm-hmm. their reference layouts. Like, here's our reference layout as a PDF. All layers of copper, everything. Here's the silk screen, everything you need.
Yeah, super nice layout.
I mean, it's not like you're going to copy that PDF and convert it directly to a KiCad file, but it is all of the data that you would need to place down the chip and place down the passives. I mean, there's a whole bill of materials for the thing. Like, hey, this is where this capacitor goes. It's exactly this size. Here's where this inductor goes. It's exactly this size. Here's, you know, extreme detail for how you need to make our reference layout.
Yeah, makes sense. As a software engineer, when I find another library that someone else has, I just let's say I'm in Python, right? Pip install the package or whatever package manager I'm using. And then bam, I'm like off to the races. I don't have to spend 2.5 weeks, you know, implementing their API, essentially. Like, they did it for me and they like handed it to me. But in the hardware world, when I'm working in KiCad, I haven't really seen like nice modules I can just like plop in and then put together. Instead, it's like all custom. You do it yourself.
It's all custom.
Time.
You do it yourself every time. Yeah. Oh, I mean, there are like nested things in some CAD softwares where you design one like section of a board and you can nest it and copy it like 4 or 5 times or however many times you need one little module. And I sort of have my own versions of those in KiCad. I mean, I have a standard ESP32 like layout and footprint. So I can just copy the schematic and place it somewhere. And that has all the components pre-assigned to it. So I set my CPU where I want it to go, and then I lay out the rest of the board around it.
Yeah, when you're
because every time I lay out the board, the placement of the capacitors changes. I want to put my antenna somewhere else. That depends on where everything is going. So I have to do the matching and the network and all of that stuff. So every time it's different, even though I have the reference layout, I still just make it from scratch instead of copying that layout from a different board. I just copy the reference schematic that I've already made that I know works.
Dang, this was really dense packed and had a lot of knowledge. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure we touched half of this, but yeah, a little bit of it, right?
But we covered a lot of good things, right? We covered, you know, how to program different microcontrollers and the kind of the process that happens, what even is a microcontroller and how it's defined, what are the different components being like
EEPROM, flash, read-only memory, bootloader,
RAM.
Yeah, RAM.
All that jazz. And also just like overall high-level architecture of really common microcontrollers. So I think overall, good little solid package there.
Dense episode.
Woo! Woo! Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for watching. I appreciate you. We'll see you guys next time.
Peace.